was standing over me. My mouth was dry. I tried to look around. There was a banner on the wall. It read, "That others may live." "Where am I?"
"In good hands, my man,"
the guy said.
"You gotta pee now."
"Pee?"
"Yeah, that's the routine. You wake up, and we gotta bring the thing around so you can get rid of some of the fluids, dig it? Just relax, and I'll take care of it for you."
I started to say something about peeing for myself, but then I saw that both of my arms were bandaged. The guy pulled back the sheets and held me while I tried to urinate. At first I couldn't. Then I managed a little.
"What happened?"
"When you remember from?"
"I was just inside the wood line," I said.
"I don't know about that part," the brother said. "All I know is that you lucky in a way, and you ain't lucky in a way. You lucky because you ain't hurt that bad. Then you ain't lucky because you ain't hurt bad enough to go back to the world."
"Where'd I get hit?"
"You had TT shrapnel in your side, in your left leg, and a few splinters in your groin. No big thing. You had a bullet wound on your wrist, but that just did barely chip your wrist. And you had a concussion. If anything will get you back to the world, it's the concussion. Get what I mean?"
He left. The right hand was bandaged. And the left hand, which I thought was bandaged, just had an IV stuck in it. Some guys in bathrobes saw me awake and came over.
"How you doing?"
"Okay, I guess."
"Yeah, just take it easy,"
one guy said. He had sergeant stripes on his bathrobe.
"Where you coming from?"
"I don't know. The valley west of Tom Key, I think.
They catching hell up there. They say Charlie riding hogs up around Quang Tree."
"Hogs?"
"Tanks, man."
"Really? Where the hell are the tanks coming from?"
"From the north through Cambodia is the word," he said. "Things are definitely getting heavy."
I thought about the rumors of peace by the end of the holidays. I made myself hope that peace was still on the way. The medical facility was like heaven. We got to eat good. We went to movies. The day room was cool. Best of all, the doctors said that none of my wounds were bad.
"You had a bad bruise of your breastbone."
The guy's name tag read, Havison. He smiled as he talked, like he enjoyed being a doctor.
"Could have been hit by something or could have been just the blast. You were lucky."
Lucky. They had a recording of a bugle that played in the morning. Everybody was shined and sharp. I hadn't realized that I wasn't until I saw the personnel around the hospital. They even had GIs tending to flowers around some of the barracks and some doing the same kinds of detail they would have been doing back in Devens or any stateside base. In the mess hall, they had Vietnamese doing KP. The ward was full of guys. Some were bandaged nearly from head to feet. Some had big lumps of bandage and tape where limbs used to be. One guy was on a kind of spit. He had been burned really bad, and they came in and turned him every 2 hours. Another guy, his name was Joe Derby, asked me to read to him. He wore dark glasses. There were scars, bad scars, on his body. He had some books and asked me to read anything I found interesting. The books were cool. I had read one of them, Platero and I, in high school. The other books were by T.S. Eliot and Steinbeck.
"Your folks send you these books?" I asked.
"My mom," he said. "I think she has ambition for me."
"What happened to you?"
"We were in a convoy going to Dak To from Khantoum. A couple of trucks up front got hit with mines. They set them off from the side of the road. We stopped, and then we got hit with everything at the same time. I was trying to get behind a truck when it was hit by a mortar."
"Oh."
I remember going up, but I don't remember coming down.
Where are you from?
Las Vegas.
I didn't ask him about his eyes. I didn't want to know. I read to him from the Jimenez, a small story about what a village looked like on a Sunday morning when everyone had gone to a bullfight. It was a simple story, and it gave you a sense of the author being at peace with the world. Once, when I looked up, I saw that he was crying. I kept on reading. I wrote Mom a letter. I tried to make it funny. I told her that I had been hit in the leg and the wrist, and now I was laying up getting fat. I told her that getting fat was my biggest problem. I thought of writing her a real letter, but I didn't have anything on my mind that I wanted her to know. I didn't want to say how afraid of dying I had been. I didn't want to say that I had a feeling that I wouldn't get back home. Brew. I thought about Brew a lot. I felt so sorry for him. I remembered laying on the chopper next to him. I remembered feeling his hand. I wondered if he had felt mine. I thought about his praying and had to push him from my mind. They moved me from one room in the hospital to a recovery ward. In the new ward, there were a lot of guys playing cards, playing dominoes. A Spec 4 asked me if I wanted to play poker. I shook my head no.
"He's a boonies rat,"
a guy said.
"You know they ain't right for 2 or 3 weeks.
"Yeah?" The Spec 4 looked me up and down.
"Maybe he can play later."
On the way to the PX, an officer stopped me and asked me why I was out of uniform. The uniform he wore had creases ironed into the shirt. Everything about him was polish and crease. He wanted to know what outfit I was with, and when he found out I was in the hospital, how long I had been there. He was challenging me, daring me to say something wrong. When he told me I could go on to the PX, I turned around and started back to the hospital. He said he thought I was going to the PX. I told him I had lost my appetite.
"Hey, good looking."
I was half asleep. I saw the name tag first. It read, Duncan. It was the nurse I had come to NAM with.
"How you doing?"
"I'm doing okay," she said, sitting on the side of the bed.
"How you doing?"
"Okay," I answered. My mouth was dry, and I took some water from the table near the bed.
"I saw your chart," she said. "I was looking in on another guy when I saw you sleeping and thought I recognized you. You been out in the boonies much?"
"Long enough to think this is heaven," I said.
"Sometimes I feel like I would rather be out there myself," she said. "I guess that's stupid, right?"
"Hey, I'm glad to see you," I said. "I'm just a little slow or something."
"Don't sweat it," she said. "You get hurt and it makes you confused. I've seen it a lot of times."
"You been here long?"
"Just transferred in when things started picking up during the Tet," she said.
"How's it going for you? Judy, right?"
"Right. It's going okay, I guess. Different than I thought it was going to be."
"Different?"
"Well, when I first talked to you in Anchorage and we were headed this way, I imagined myself rushing around and fixing up neat little bullet holes and giving out peppermints. That's not the way it is. You see that?"
"Yeah."
"Look, I have to see some other guys. You take care of yourself, Perry." "Perry, what's your first name?"
"Richie."
"Richie, you take care of yourself."
She kissed me and left. A couple of guys made comments about her kissing me. One asked me if I was getting over with her. I shrugged him off without answering.
He mumbled something about guys from the boonies being strange. Maybe they were right. I had felt awkward talking to Judy. I was glad to see her, but I couldn't talk to her. The words didn't have the right proportion somehow. There was this feeling that everything I was going to say was either too loud or too strange for a world in which people did normal things. I thought about Judy. She had seemed so upbeat on the plane. She had come over to me and started talking. Now she seemed tired, sad. I hoped she would be okay. I cried for Brew. Sometimes, even when I wasn't thinking about him, or at least when I didn't know I was thinking about him, I would find myself crying. When the tears came, I thought about Brew and the sound the zipper made in the chopper. Days went by. Stars and Stripes had a story about the Pueblo, and some guys were talking about the possibility of the U.S. getting involved with Korea again. The chaplain and a colonel came in and talked to a bunch of us. The chaplain said that everything we did for the highest reasons that men knew. "You are defending freedom," he said. "You are defending the freedom of Americans and of the South Vietnamese. Your acts of heroism and courage are celebrations of life, and all America thanks you." Then the colonel gave out Purple Hearts to the guys who didn't already have them. I decided to send my medal for being wounded in action to Kenny. I wrote to Kenny again. I told him that I had read about the garbage strike in New York. I told him that when I got back to the world, we would do a lot of things together. Maybe we would go downtown to the museums. Kenny liked museums. I think, in a way, he felt safe in them. I told him we would go to games at Madison Square Garden, maybe even take Mama if she wanted to go. I thought about what Pee-wee had said, that I had better think about killing the Kongs before they killed me. That had better be my reason, he had said, until I got back to the world. Maybe it was right. But it meant being some other person than I was when I got to Nam. Maybe that was what I had to be. Somebody else. When the doctors had finished looking at the wounds, I knew what they would say. They said I looked okay. The shrapnel, small slivers of metal, hadn't hit anything vital. They were pretty sure they had dug out all the pieces. The doctor made a joke about missing a piece that I could tell my grandchildren about. The wrist had healed nicely. The doctor showed me the chip in the bone in the first X-ray. Then he showed me a second X-ray. It was cloudy and I didn't make anything of it. He said it showed that the bone was growing back. They had to come. My orders to rejoin my unit. When the clerk brought them, he made me sign for them. He left, and I threw them on the bed and went to breakfast. When I got back, they were still there. I read all the orders on the page, not just mine. Baines, Jones, Edward, Jones, Nance, Naylor, Perry. No, I said no to myself. I wouldn't go back. I would go AWOL. I packed my things. I went to the John and puked my guts out. I was scared. I felt almost the way I had in the chopper. I couldn't breathe. My hands were sweating. What would I do? I had heard of guys running away to Sweden. How the hell did you get to Sweden from Nam? Was there still a Sweden to run to? The orders said that I was to report back to my outfit, where I would report to my commanding officer. I went to say goodbye to Joe Derby and some of the other guys. The guy on the spit was gone. I hoped he made it. "Get back to the world, Perry," Derby said. "I'm pushing for it, man." Everything was going too fast. I couldn't handle it. No way. The plane was full of Marines, fresh from Camp Lejeune. They were tough, full of themselves. They seemed so young. They kidded back and forth among themselves. They had weapons. Some of them looked at me and some asked me questions. Had I been in country long? Had I seen any action? They were itching to get into combat. I had been in the country 4 months. I hadn't seen a lot of action, but enough. Lord knows it was enough. Chapter 17. We were camped at an old landing strip just north of Tam Key, and less than 1,000 meters from Highway 1. I was glad to be near the highway. To the west, rice paddies stretched for what seemed miles. The dikes were twisted, uneven. I wondered how many battles had been fought along them. There were guys, mostly ARVN troops, sitting in tight little circles under the trees. I looked around for Americans and finally found some. I asked them if they knew where Alpha Company was.
"Up the hill, a piece,"
a tired-looking guy said. I walked up the hill slowly. I could see small clusters of soldiers sitting around. It was less than a company, maybe a squad or two at the most. I was afraid again. I had felt it coming when I got my orders. I had felt it on the chopper. Now it set like a heavy ball in my guts. The dirt on the hill was soft beneath my feet. Trees, once splintered, had begun to grow again along the path. I stepped on the boot prints that were there. The Vietnamese voices below me, ARVN troops, followed me up the hill. Pee-wee was standing near a tree, peeing. God bless Pee-wee. "Hey, buddy, you see any soldiers around here?"
"Man, you as sneaky as the damn Kongs," Pee-wee said, looking up. "I ain't even hear you coming."
"How's it going?"
"Not too cold," Pee-wee
said. He was rearranging his clothes as he talked.
"What's up?" "First things first," he said. "How the fuck you doing?"
"No big deal," I said. "A couple of scratches."
"I was hoping you were back in the world," Pee-wee said. "I was hoping you was back in Harlem getting loved up by 3 big hip mamas and wearing you some wingtip kicks by now."
"I was kind of hoping myself," I said.
"We ain't done a thing since you've been gone but sit out here in this fucking rain and mud," Pee-wee said. "I've been sitting in this shit so long my piles got wrinkles."
"Everybody okay?"
"Yeah, I said we ain't done nothing,"
Pee-wee said.
"But you see who we with down the way?"
"The ARVNs?"
"Yeah, but that ain't the bad news," Pee-wee
said.
"Come on, we got some barbecue pork chops on the fire."
"Where did you get pork chops?"
"Wallowick shot a pig and cut the sucker up,"
Pee-wee said.
"We've been eating good since we've been out here."
"What's the bad news?" I said, walking alongside of him. We went over to where Monaco was squatting with a bottle of soda. Monaco looked up, then he stood and threw both arms around me and hugged me. It really touched me. I thought I was going to cry.
"I'm sorry you're back," he said, "but I'm real glad to see you, man. Real glad."
I started to say something about being glad to see him too, but I felt something wrong in the air. I looked from Monaco to Pee-wee.
"So what's up?"
"Simpson went back to the world."
Pee-wee looked up at the sky. I followed his gaze. The skies were a dirty gray. There was a thick cloud cover, heavy and threatening, above us. A large bird started into the air as if it had been thrown, then stopped, spread its wings, and glided in a great arc to the west.
"He okay when he left?"
"Yeah," Pee-wee said, "but I ain't too sure about the new sergeant. He's a first sergeant and he old."
"How old?"
"Guy's at least 30-something, Monaco said. "He could even be 40. He took Monaco off point and put me on," Pee-wee said. "I didn't think nothing about it at first until he put me on all the damn time. Then he told Brunner he didn't want him pulling the rear. He put Johnson on the rear with the damn pig."
Johnson's carrying the 60 in the rear?
Yeah.
What did Johnson say?
Johnson asked him to his damn face, Pee-wee said. He asked him how come he put a brother on point and another brother in the damn rear with the 60.
I looked at Monaco. He looked back at me.
What did he say?
Dongan.
That's his name, Pee-wee said. He said he do what he think he should do, and it ain't for Johnson to tell him what to do.
What did Johnson say?
Johnson said he gonna mess around and get himself shot in the back of the head.
It rained for 7 days straight. We sat in the rain for 7 days straight. The mud oozed up into our boots, into our clothes, into our skins. There wasn't any way to get dry. There was talk about us standing down in Okinawa, but nobody took it seriously. There was a lot of talk about how well the other units in the outfit were doing, but the guys in the squad seemed a little different, tired. They seemed really tired. For the first 5 days after I got back, I didn't get to talk to Dongan. He nodded toward me once or twice, and that was it. I got an M16 and a grenade launcher from the armorer and found out that we had to carry more ammunition than I thought we would. Gearhart came around and talked to us a couple of times, but Dongan stayed away. Johnson was getting a thing about him. I went over and talked to Johnson. I wanted to find out more about Dongan, but Johnson wouldn't deal with it. He asked me what I thought about Brew.
I liked him, I said.
He's probably back home now, he said.
Brew?
Yeah.
There was something about the way Johnson looked at me. I looked at Lobel and he shook his head.
Probably back home, I said.
When Johnson went to Chow, I asked Lobel what the hell was going on with him about Brew.
He's just not accepting the idea that he's dead, Lobel said.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means you ask too many questions, Lobel said.
That's what was going on. The questions kept coming and nobody wanted to deal with them. Johnson didn't want to deal with Brew being dead, and Lobel didn't want to deal with Johnson. Maybe I did ask too many questions.
The first day the weather lifted a little, a chopper came in with a priest. Pee-wee had made a checkerboard out of some leaves he wove together. He was good at that kind of thing. We played checkers day and night. We were playing checkers when the Huey came in with the chaplain. The chaplain was Catholic, and the Catholic guys had a mass or something. Then he came around to the rest of us. He didn't look like a chaplain. What he looked like was a middleweight who fought preliminaries in Atlantic City. His name was Father Santora.
Sometimes, he said, prayer can be very comforting. I wonder if any of you men would like to pray with me.
No, I said.
Why not?
You wouldn't understand if I told you, I said.
Try me, he said.
I just don't want to pray, I said.
Figure you don't want to make your peace if you're not ready to die?
I smiled. I had to smile. He was right, and he knew it.
Something like that. I know how you feel, he said. I'm not quite ready to die just yet either.
You ever go into combat?
Into combat?
Yes.
I've never fired a weapon at anyone, though.
You figure if you don't shoot at anybody, God's gonna take care of you?
Pee-wee asked.
I don't know, he said. I sure as hell hope so.
The big guns in the distance kept rumbling. The sound seemed to rumble through the hills and flatten out over the valley.
If I pray with you, will it keep me alive? I asked.
No.
What will it do for me?
I don't know, he said. I think it can be comforting at times.
You can't say anything better than that?
He shrugged.
You scared being over here? I asked.
Yeah.
He nodded his head.
I'm scared.
We got the squad together. We told him some of the things that had happened to us. Then he prayed, asking God to take care of us and our loved ones. Things like that. I really appreciated it. Then he started asking God to look out for Bruce's soul. That's when Johnson walked away. Right in the middle of a prayer, he walked away. Father Centura looked up at him and he was puzzled. Or at least I think he was puzzled. When the prayer was over, Father Centura had to split.
Where you going? Monaco asked. Some place named Quezon,
Father Centura said.
How come all these places over here have such foreign-sounding names?
Johnson and Dongan got into a pretty heavy argument about how Johnson was keeping the 60. Dongan didn't think the extra barrel that Johnson had to keep was clean enough. Johnson was telling him that he needed a grenade up his ass. They got real close to each other, and Johnson pushed Dongan away from him. Lieutenant Gearhart got Johnson away from Sergeant Dongan and started pushing him toward the HQ hooch. Pee-wee told Johnson that if anything funky went down, that he could count on him.
You can count on me too, I said.
I meant it too. The squad didn't need any crap to get us separated. I knew that, and I was sure that Pee-wee did too. But we didn't have to take any crap either. Guard duty. Me, Lobel, Pee-wee, and Sergeant Dongan. He said that he wanted to pull guard to check us out. When he said that, Pee-wee opened his pants and told him to check out his crotch. Sergeant Dongan was from Richmond, Indiana. He sounded Southern, he looked Southern, and he seemed to think Southern. Brunner was sucking up to him as per usual. Johnson outlined the problem.
Me, Pee-wee, Perry, and Monaco is the niggas of this outfit, he said. We gotta keep a serious watch on our asses.
I believed him. Monaco was Italian, but he was the same as the black guys in Dongan's eyes. Maybe because he got along with us so well. I don't know. We went out on guard duty at 2000 hours. It was my first real duty since I had got back to the squad. I hit the guard position and inspected it. It looked okay. It was a foxhole with sandbags around the top and boards at the bottom to stand on. The boards were rickety, but they were better than oozing down into the mud. I lifted the boards and dug it down another foot. Noises. The crickets and creepy crawlies were out in force. Crickets made a terrible racket. Things slithering through the grass could wake up the dead. The moon floating above us scraped against the clouds. Noises. My watch's ticking was louder than my heartbeat. There was something out there. No, it was just the darkness. What was out there was me, fearful, crying in the night. I was afraid. I thought of Father Centura. A noise. Was it a click? What was it? Another noise. I saw Sergeant Dongan move his right arm. He seemed to be groping about in the darkness. He found something. He swung his arm in a tight arc. A grenade. Thump. It hit. Nothing. It didn't go off. I glanced up. There was movement. What might be a voice? Sergeant Dongan fired a short burst. There was a muffled scream. He fired off a flare. It went high into the air, ignited, then parachuted slowly toward the ground, lighting the entire area. There was one dead VC, a sapper with his wire cutter still in his hand, his lifeless body draped across the wire. I looked around, but I didn't see anything else. Slowly, the light from the flare died. It was dark. The boogeyman could come out again. Minutes passed. An hour passed. We were relieved by a crew of grim-faced ARVN Marines.
What a time for a dud grenade, Lobel said.
Ain't threw no dud, Dungan said. Threw a damn rock. That gook ducked his head down when he heard it land. Then he wondered why it didn't go off. Stuck his head up and I popped him. Learned that from the 3rd Marines.
The man knew what he was doing. He knew how to stay alive. Back at the hooch, Lobel came over and sat on Pee-wee's bunk. Pee-wee said that anybody who sat on his bunk had to give him a kiss. Lobel said he wasn't a faggot, and Pee-wee said he was sorry about that because he could have really used a kiss.
You guys think we're going to have a race problem over here?
Lobel asked.
Not as long as everybody over here got them a gun,
Pee-wee said. Lobel stood up.
Well, just in case we do, he said, I want you to know you got the Jew on your side.
Who's the Jew? Pee-wee asked.
Me. I'm a Jew.
You ain't no Jew,
Pee-wee said.
You too tall.
Fuck you, Pee-wee.
There you go with them promises again,
Pee-wee said. The rain stopped. We sat. We did nothing. The war was a million miles away. Wallowick told me and Pee-wee that they were talking about progress in the Paris peace talks.
Perry!
Pee-wee was hanging over the edge of his bunk directing traffic for an ant traffic jam.
What? You ever have your black ass in Paris?
No.
Where you been?
New York.
You know where I been?
Where?
Chicago and Petersburg, Virginia. I got me a cousin in Petersburg. We work in a library down there.
What'd he do?
He run the whole thing.
How we get to do that?
He just smart as hell,
Pee-wee said. A joint operation. Captain Stewart came around to tell us we had to look good because we were going to be working with the Marines. He made it sound like a job.
We'll be going into the Phuoc Ha Valley. The Marine unit will move in first and clear the area, he said. Then we'll secure it and establish an LZ in the valley. Is that clear?
We didn't do anything. Like half the plans that came down from the regiment, this one was canceled. The Marines had started a counteroffensive up near Kaysan and moved up there instead of into the Phuoc Ha Valley. We were glad of that. Damn glad. Lobel tried to get up a volleyball game, but nobody wanted to play. We got Gearhart to requisition some gloves and baseballs from battalion supply. We got word that General Westmoreland wanted us to maximize destruction of the enemy.
What the fuck does that mean?
Pee-wee asked.
We get a Kong, we supposed to kill his ass twice?
No, monkey face. It means that we're supposed to kill as many of these gooks as we can,
Brunner said.
You gonna monkey face your way right to Arlington Cemetery,
Pee-wee said. Later, lying in the bunk, sweltering in the heat, I wondered what it did mean about maximizing destruction. Would it mean that we would simply kill more? But who would we kill? Maybe we would be quicker to shoot in the hamlets. Maybe we would stop pretending that we knew who the enemy was and let ourselves believe that all the Vietnamese were the enemy. That would be the easy way. The women, the babies, the old men with their rounded backs and thin brown legs. They would be the enemy, all of them. And we would be those who killed the enemy. Okay. I got a letter from Pee-wee's girlfriend. The first thing she told me is that Pee-wee said I'm nice looking and educated. Then she went on to say how she was sorry she couldn't wait for Pee-wee anymore. Pee-wee wasn't around when I got the letter, so I just burned it. I got a letter from Kenny, too. He said he had a part-time job working at Kelly's Drugs on the corner of Lenox and 118th Street. For some reason, I felt so proud of him that he would do that. I just hoped Mama was letting him keep all the money he made. He also said that he heard that Johnny Robinson got killed in the Nam.
Johnny Robinson?
The last time I remember seeing him was when we were playing 3-on-3 in Morningside Park. Johnny couldn't play that well, but he always tried hard. I had always thought he was younger than me. I didn't know how he could even be in the NOM. Tuesday. Raining. It promised to be the worst day of the war. We were sitting on the side of the hill. Johnson, Monaco, and Lobel had got some money together, and we were playing poker with some guys from Charlie Company. They called it Charlie Company, but it wasn't really anything more than three squads at best. Three thin squads at that. The ARVNs caught a woman with two children coming along the edge of the paddies. They stopped her and started slapping her around. Some guys from Charlie Company stopped them and brought the woman and the two kids to the HQ hooch. HQ didn't have an interpreter, and the ARVN interpreter didn't get anything from the woman. They finally let her go. Pee-wee wanted to give the kids the checkerboard he had made.
"They probably don't even play checkers over here," Sergeant Dongan said.
"No lie," Pee-wee said.
"Maybe I'll make them a doll or something."
He went over and started grabbing a handful of grass and started making a doll. It was important to him. I could see that, but I didn't know why. He wanted to make those children something, to give them something. I watched as some guys from Charlie Company started talking to the Vietnamese woman. They were just kidding around with her, talking stupid stuff about how they were looking for some cheerleaders. They followed her to the edge of the camp. Meanwhile, Pee-wee was working hard trying to get his little doll together to give to her kids. I watched as Pee-wee stood, putting the last touches on the doll. I thought it was cool when the woman stopped just before she reached the dikes and handed one of the kids to a guy from Charlie Company. The GI's arms and legs flung apart from the impact of the blast. The damn kid had been mined, had exploded in his arms. Guys not even near him, guys who had just been watching him take the kid into his arms, fell to the ground as if the very idea of a kid exploding in your arms had its own power, its own killing force. I saw the woman running across the paddy. I saw her fold backward as the automatic fire ripped her nearly apart. I saw part of her body move in one direction and her legs in another. The woman's other child stood for a long moment, knee-deep in water and mud, before it, too, was gunned down. I turned and saw Pee-wee walking away. The doll he made lay face down in the endless mud. It was raining again. Chapter 18. Pee-wee skipped his meals the rest of the day. Monaco tried to talk to him, but he wouldn't answer. It was Johnson who finally got him to talk.
"Hey, Pee-wee."
"What?"
"You care anything about these damn kids over here, man?"
"They got kids over here?"
Pee-wee asked.
"Nah, man, all they got is Kongs," Johnson said. "Kongs and mosquitoes."
"And rats,"
Wallowick added.
"Yeah."
"Hey, Pee-wee," I said. "It's okay to feel bad about what's going on over here, man. It's really okay."
"Me feel bad?"
Pee-wee turned over in his bunk and pulled his sheet up around his shoulders.
"Never happened."
The first thing in the morning, a guy got hit. Lobel saw it and told me about it. A medic was handing out malaria pills. The guy had just put the pill into his mouth and was getting water from one of the water cans when he got hit in the rear end. "First, the guy turned around because he thought somebody was screwing around with him," Lobel said. "Then he felt his ass and looked at his hand. He saw the blood and knew he had been hit. Then he thought that one of us had shot him and he started looking at us. Then another shot hit the water can and we all dove for cover." There was no way to find any VC in the area.
A shot would come from the woods and you'd return fire, killing a lot of the vegetation without ever hitting the sniper. If you did hit him, you wouldn't know about it. The guy that got hit was a private. Everybody was standing around him congratulating him on his wound. He'd have a chance to get back to Chulai for a week or so. And it wasn't a bad hit. It was funny. A guy could get hit, be inches from being killed or crippled for life, and make a joke of it. It was all part of Nam. Some parts you could laugh at, like getting hit in the ass. Other parts, like the kid blowing up, you tried to shut out of your mind. Johnson came over to where I was trying to down some scrambled eggs before the flying bugs got them. What I would do is to wave my fork over the eggs until all the bugs flew away. Then grab a forkful before they came back. Johnson sat down on the ground next to me and watched me for a while.
"The officers ain't eating no powdered eggs," Johnson said.
"What are they eating?"
"Dehydrated potatoes."
"How come they get all the good stuff?"
"They're having a big fight over at HQ Hooch," Johnson said.
"What about?"
"We're supposed to go on a joint patrol with the ARVNs, and the ARVN colonel wants us to get into position first. Captain Stewart wants the ARVNs to go in first."
"Stewart told you that?"
"Gearhart." Johnson grunted the name.
"He say anything else about Dongan?"
"Nothing he can say," Johnson said. "Dongan made them switches too fast. Soon as he got here, he looked around and did his thing. He might know how to keep himself together, but I don't want him doing it by getting me killed."
There was something about Johnson that was different than the rest of us. There was a knowing about him, as if he had been here before, as if dying and fighting was something he had been born to. When he talked about Dongan, I listened.
"First thing he done was to sit down and have him a beer with Brunner. Then he had him a beer with Wallowick. He don't like Lobo because he think Lobo's a faggot. He even asked me if he was a faggot."
It made me feel good to hear Johnson say that. I didn't think he would have said it when he first came into the army, or even when he first got into the squad. But we had all learned something about dying and about trying to keep each other alive. It was good. "What did you say?"
"I didn't say nothing," Johnson said. "I don't talk that shit. A man in Nam fighting by my side is a man fighting by my side. I don't care what he doing in bed."
We watched as the guy who had been hit in the rear end came out of the tent. He had a big smile on his face. His boots were unlaced and he was walking with a limp. The medic was just helping him into a jeep when he got hit a second time. It was another TT hit, on his hand. But this time somebody saw where the fire had come from. A squad went out to look for the sniper. He probably could have stayed in his tree or his hole for the rest of the war without being caught, but he elected to fire on the squad. They pinned him down with automatic fire while the mortar squad set up. It must have cost $10,000 to kill him.
"You hear what happened?"
Pee-wee's fatigues hung on him loosely. There were dark stains under the arms that were ringed with salt at the edges.
"What happened?"
Johnson looked at Pee-wee.
"The little Viet colonel gave Stewart a direct order to take some damn hill. Stewart said he wasn't going up first, and the colonel called division."
"Now what's going to happen?" Johnson asked.
"Now we going up the damn hill first," Pee-wee said.
"What it is," Lieutenant Gearhart was saying, "is a small hill overlooking a village called Fuak Ha Too. There's been activity on the hill, and they want it checked out. The thing is, this colonel is the same one who was leading some ARVN troops that got ambushed along Route 534. Got a whole battalion wasted."
"Let's just not go," Pee-wee said.
"Division said we had to go, so we're going," Gearhart answered.
We're going to call in artillery to soften up the area. Then explore the slopes off the paddies. All we want to do is draw fire if there's any unfriendlies there.
Pee-wee wrote down the number of the highway that the ARVN colonel's battalion had been ambushed on and said that he was going to send it to his barber, who took numbers back home, and have him play it for the whole month.
I feel lucky, he said.
It was the first time I had seen Pee-wee actually smile since I was back. It was funny that he should smile when we might be going into a firefight. First, we choppered into a hot LZ, and the pilots jerked us out and took us out of there and into the valley itself, which didn't seem hot. We were getting fire support from Tam Key, and there was no response from the hill we were supposed to be moving on to. That didn't mean a damn thing. I had heard stories about artillery fire taking off the entire top of a mountain and then having the Kongs come out of the ground. Their bunkers were deeper than ours. A lot deeper. The new LZ was a makeshift number. We were bunched up pretty good, and I was just praying that we hit the wood line before we got fire. The enemy was close enough for us to hear the sounds of their mortars firing. The rounds were going long, but more important, they weren't detonating. You could hear them whistling overhead, but then there wouldn't be an explosion. We figured it was either defective equipment or the Kong mortar squad didn't know how to arm them. That wouldn't last long. A black lieutenant took Charlie Company to the right of the hill we were supposed to hit, and Lieutenant Gearhart took us to the left. We started advancing in as wide a skirmish line as I had seen, but there was still no return fire. Our squad was on the deep flank, and I was far man. We had to cross a paddy field to get to the wood line that led to the hill we were going to explore. This was why the ARVNs didn't want to go first. The paddy area was at least the size of a football field and exposed. I breathed a little easier when we reached the wood line. Lieutenant Gearhart picked the route with the most cover for us. We went through a heavy canopy area, and the branches scratched my face and ripped at my hands. I was jumping through bushes, hoping I didn't hit any booby traps, avoiding anything that looked like it might be a step easier. I was struggling to keep up. The 2 weeks in the hospital had done a number on me. Just two lousy weeks. The M16 felt like 16 pounds instead of 5. Jamal carried the radio, and Gearhart was on it. He gave us the signal to stay put, and I got down behind a fallen tree. Pee-wee crawled over to me.
I got a coin back home, he said. You go in my room and look in the back of the closet on the floor. You find a sneaker there, and in the sneaker there's a sock with some stuff in it. Most of the stuff ain't worth nothing, but that coin is real old.
Yeah?
If I don't get out this shit, you go get that coin, Pee-wee said. My mom's might be a little uptight thinking you trying to rip her off or some shit. But if you gotta buy it from her, you do that. We get out this particular mess, and I'll write her and tell her to save it for you.
That's all he said. Then he started crawling back to his position. And Minnie had a bad feeling about this place. We heard some light fire on the other side of the mountain. The 60 was stuttering. Once in a while, I thought I heard the M16s, but I couldn't be sure. Some rounds of high explosives came in on top of the hill. I tensed. I looked over to where Lobo was snuggling up to the base of a tree trunk. I gave him the thumbs up sign, and he returned it. We waited. I checked my watch, and it was 10:00 hours. The barrage on the hill stopped. The sounds of a firefight on the other side of the hill picked up. Still, our squad waited. Gearhart was signaling. I looked over at him. He was pointing toward the trees. Okay, look out for snipers. I tried to make myself smaller. Don't think. Just be alert. Sergeant Simpson used to say it over and over again. But I was thinking. Gearhart waved his arm in the air. Crap. We started getting up. I had to pee. I'd do it later. I must have had a pee ratio of 3-1 in Nam versus the amount of times I had peed in Harlem. We had to move around the base of the hill to another area. Gerhardt took us away from the wood line and back toward the paddies.
"What the fuck's he doing?"
Pee-wee asked.
"Trying to draw fire?"
Wallowick said. We were showing ourselves, being targets. We moved along the edge of the paddy. The ground was muddy, oozing with water.
"Stay away from the dikes," Sergeant Dongan called out. "Keep your distances."
I was wearing a flak jacket. Pee-wee had found two and had given me one. It weighed a ton. We kept moving. We kept slipping in the mud. Monaco had pushed forward faster than the rest of us. I think he wanted the point. He hit a dry spot and stopped. He held his rifle over his head and we all stopped. He knelt and then stepped off the dry spot into the paddy. We all followed him into the paddy. When I passed the dry spot, I saw how smooth it looked. Maybe it was too smooth. Maybe it was mined. That's what Monaco must have thought. I thought that if I got killed, I would want it to be over quick. I wanted to be hit and not even realize what was happening. I'd be gone like Lieutenant Carroll. Over, out. I don't want to lay screaming. I don't want to be carried in a medevac chopper while guys you could be home playing ball with were banging on your chest, trying to get your heart beating again. Don't think. The rice paddy seemed forever. The water was up past my ankles and the stink was something else.
"Johnson, hit that line of trees,"
Dongan called out. Johnson held the 60 at his waist. He leaned into it and fired. I saw that he had something on his left hand. It looked like one of those mittens you use to handle hot pots, only it was silver. We kept moving. The rice paddy ended. We were crouched, moving forward toward the wood line again. We hadn't drawn fire. We moved up the hill. It was steep. We slid and fell. I fell and let myself slide backward. I was afraid to catch on to anything. We fired a few shots, even though we didn't see anything. We went up 30, 40 meters. Nothing. Gerhardt signaled us to stop. We looked around and found cover. Wait. It was 11:30 hours. We dug in. Charlie had taught us well. We rested. We sat. Gerhardt was on the radio. I tried to read him from where I was. Next to Gerhardt, lying exhausted on the ground, was Jamal. Lobo was sitting against a tree. When I saw him, I froze. His eyes were open, but there was no expression in them.
"Lobo,"
I called to him.
"What?
You okay?"
"Yeah."
"Shit, I thought you were dead." He smiled. His face was caked with dirt, and the smile showed his teeth. The blank expression in his eyes never changed. We waited until almost 1,200 hours before Gerhardt signaled for us to move out. We moved back down the hill. We backed down the best we could. We got to the bottom and then ran the distance back to the paddy. Then we started back through it. It began to rain lightly. The trip back through the paddy went faster than it did the other way. We got away from the paddy and started moving toward the LZ. Stewart was already there when we got there. He was pissed. He told Gerhardt to get over to the command post. Gerhardt glanced toward us and then left.
"What was that all about?"
Lobel and Wallowick came over to where the rest of the squad was already sitting.
"All I know is that Gerhardt got the order to regroup here," Jamal said. "It's my lunchtime," Pee-wee said, "so we had to break." "Check your weapon,"
Dongan said to Johnson.
"It's okay," Johnson said, not moving.
"I said check your fucking weapon."
Johnson looked up at Dungan and then started stripping the 60.
What makes you such a hot shot?
Monaco asked Dungan.
When you were still pissing your pants, I was kicking ass, kid,
Dungan said.
This ain't no fucking war. These slants can't fight. You go up against the Koreans, then you got your damn hands full.
We listened to Sergeant Dongan talk about how hard things had been in the Korean War and how tough the Koreans had been. I didn't care. I hadn't been in Korea, and I hadn't been in any other wars. I was in Nam.